KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. For over 30 years, Stanford neuroscientist Robert Sapolsky has combined fieldwork on primates with neurological research in the laboratory, producing unique insights into primate and human behavior. Sapolsky joins us to talk about his latest research on stress and the brain. And Forum is next, with your calls, emails, and online web and Facebook posted questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Professor Dr. Robert Sapolsky is professor of biology, neurology, neurological sciences, and neurosurgery at the Stanford School of Medicine. As I said, nobody really owns him, no department. He's also a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and he made a name for himself by living with wild baboons in Kenya, East Africa, and recording their behavior. He's the author of Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, The Trouble with Testosterone, A Primate's Memoir, and Monkey Love, and is published widely, including in The New Yorker, and The New York Times, and The LA Times, and joins us. And welcome back to Forum, Robert Sapolsky. Good to have you here.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
And we should mention that the two of us will be at Herp Theater this evening, talking on stage at City Arts and Lectures. But let's talk now about stress, which has become a big... it's become a subject that's more and more identified with you because of the work you did back in Kenya, observing chimps who had, baboons who had a good deal of time on their hands. But you've been working on a stress vaccine. You've learned what from the baboons that we need to know, and what about stress that affects us as humans?
Well, you know, if you want to summarize 30 years of lab work, it's... stress is not good for your brain. And
I'm putting you in a stressful position, am I?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it's very nice that you were okay with us being in pajamas here. This is very relaxing. And if you want to summarize 30 years of fieldwork...
Don't summarize 30 years of fieldwork. Give me what the top of this is. I mean, how close are we to really understanding, or have we come to understand stress through what you observed with baboons in our own lives?
Not very well. Mainly because we have this somewhat of an uphill battle here. You know, if you're your basic off-the-rack mammal, what stress is about is somebody has leapt out, ripped your stomach open, your innards are dragging in the dust, you still need to get out of there. What stress is typically about is a short-term physical crisis where if you're going to get through this, you need energy to whatever muscles, or you're going to save your neck. You need to turn off everything that's not essential. You're on sheer triage crisis mode. And the trouble with us and some other smart primates is we're smart enough and socially privileged enough to be able to devote huge amounts of time to inventing psychological stress. And the killer in the whole field is the fact that you turn on the exact same stress response, adrenaline and, you know, 11 other hormones, and they're the same stress response as does some zebra running for its life from a lion, and we turn it on for purely psychological reasons. And the punchline of the whole field is that's not what it evolved for being turned on for chronic reasons, having nothing to do with actual physical reality.
But, you know, you often hear the argument, talking largely about humans, maybe baboons would make the same argument, I don't know, that you need stress. I mean, living in a competitive dog-eat-dog world, tooth and claw and all that, and I hear people say all the time, you know, I get ahead and I'm more productive because of the stress on me.
Well, we need stress. Not only do we need stress and getting ahead and all of that, but we love stress. We absolutely love stress. We'll pay good money to be stressed as long as it's the right kind. We'll pay good money to be terrified in a scary movie, to have our like innards flung to one side unexpectedly on a roller coaster. We love stress under certain constraints when it's only moderate in severity. You're not expecting to get on the roller coaster to have your limbs severed. You're only expecting to be made a little bit queasy. When it's transient, you know, it's not for nothing that roller coaster rides aren't 3 weeks long. But most importantly, where it's in a context that overall feels safe. Because when we feel safe, what we're willing to do is allow ourselves to be stressed a little bit. What do we call a moderate transient amount of stress in a safe setting? We call it stimulation. And we love that. The goal of stress sort of physiology and stress research is not to get rid of stress in our lives. Whether you're dealing with babies or people in nursing homes or everything in between, you know, the goal isn't to get rid of stimulation.
It's excess stress that you're talking about?
Yeah, or it's of the
fight or flight stress, that kind of thing?
And ones that for the most part just go on for too long. Transient ones we're pretty good with. And in fact, the neurochemistry of what's happened transiently with a stressor fits that short term, like a couple of minutes worth of stress that's not too severe, your brain secretes a neurotransmitter in one area of the brain, a neurotransmitter called dopamine. And dopamine is all about pleasure and reward. Cocaine works on this dopamine system. What's that about? The right amount of short-term stress feels good. That's stimulation. That's coming out of a roller coaster or the scary movie completely oxygenated and euphoric or whatever. That's, you know,
maybe
the
even
right
elevated. But you talk about it as a present-day plague, and you talk about it killing brain cells and hurting the immune system. That's at a certain level. And again, how do we know when we're at that level, or how do we know when the baboons are at that level?
Well, with the baboons, one of the things I'm able to do out there, and these are wild baboons that I've been going back to the same animals for more than 30 years now.
You're in the troop, right?
Well, in a very, I don't know, you
ex officio?
Have to ask them. Yes, yes. Insofar as I am a very low-ranking primate in their society, but I'm definitely not a fly in the wall when I'm out there. They know you're around. But these are animals who've gotten pretty habituated to having humans around, and these are guys who I can dart, anesthetize with a blowgun and take blood samples and tissue biopsies and such. And when you poke around in them, what stress-related poor health looks like is an awful lot like in us. You get elevated blood pressure. You get elevated levels of this one class of stress hormones, cortisol. Your cholesterol levels are rotten. Your immune system doesn't work very well. You know, your brain chemistry is one prone more in the direction of anxiety, just like a human who is psychologically stressed for a great deal of time and whose body is beginning to pay for it.
And just like humans, it turns out baboons kill, and they don't necessarily kill just for survival or for predatory necessity of eating or anything like that.
No, I mean, that was one of the great sort of sound bites of every like heartwarming, you know, National Geographic special way back when I was a kid, of, you know, at the end, only humans are the only species that kills. There are plenty of other species that kill out there, that kill competitively, strategically, gratuitously, premeditatively in some cases. Chimps are probably the best studied examples, but certainly among my baboons, who are aggressive, hierarchical, backstabbing schemers, you certainly get males killing each other. You get coalitions of males doing that, and it is a very familiar sight in lots of ways. I mean, these are perfect animals for what I've been studying over the years, because what, you know, I wanted to look at is, why do some bodies and why do some psyches deal better with stress than others? What does it have to do with your social rank, your personality, your patterns of social affiliation, all that sort of thing? And baboons wind up being perfect for this very simple reason. The ones that I study who are out in the Serengeti, this is like the greatest ecosystem on Earth if you're a baboon. Like very low predation rates. They live in these big troops, 50, 100 animals or so. The lions don't mess with them.
A lot of time on their hands.
A lot of time on their hands. They only have to work like 3 hours a day for their calories. They've got 9 hours of free time every day to devote to being incredibly awful to some other baboon. They're just like us. They've got this ecological luxury that they can devote all day long to generating psychological stress for each other.
But the hierarchy you spoke of before, this rather rigid hierarchy, has a lot to do with the aggression, and it also has a lot to do with their longevity, it turns out.
Yeah. So you got male baboons and females, I say for readers who are not aware of such things. So you got male baboons, and they have a hierarchical system that shifts over time. Male baboons change troops at puberty. They get utterly bored with everybody in their own small town. They pick up, they move to another troop, slowly work their way up the hierarchy. Females, on the other hand, spend their whole life in the same troop. They inherit their rank from their mother. So two very different ranking systems. And say among the males, who are the ones I've predominantly studied over the years and some reasons for that, among them, you want to know one single fact about a guy's life that's going to tell you an awful lot about the quality of how his hours pass by. It's his dominance rank. It's these linear hierarchies, number one, number 10, number 20, and it makes a huge difference in terms of, you know, obvious stuff, reproductive success, which tracks your rank to some extent, but, you know, do you get the best food? If somebody's gotten a kill of something, do you get to steal it from them? Do you get to sit in the shade during the hottest part of the day? Probably most importantly, if you're in a foul mood, do you have the luxury of having somebody smaller around you could take it out on? Displacement aggression. These guys are all about finding somebody weaker and smaller to give an ulcer to when they're feeling frazzled.
So why is it zebras don't get ulcers?
I think basically they're not smart enough. I mean, you look at a zebra and it's out there and, you know, over the years in the savannah, I've spent a lot of years looking at zebras and they're not sort of sizzling in the seeming existential challenges they're wrestling with. You know, a zebra is out there eating grass. A lion leaps out, is running after it. The zebra runs like mad. Fortunately, things work out okay. The lion gives up. And as far as I can tell, 45 seconds later, the zebra's back at the grass eating it without a clue as to what just occurred. They don't have psychological stress. They don't have anticipatory stress. They're basically not smart enough to make themselves sick with this nonsense. It's not till you get the smart, social, long-lived primates, probably elephants, cetaceans and stuff, that you have animals that have like the vulnerability to think themselves into being ill, like us.
Our guest again, if you've just joined us, is Dr. Robert Sapolsky, who is professor of biology, neurology, and neurological sciences, as well as neurosurgery at Stanford, and the author of many books, including Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Now, there was, and you've written about this, a study done by a fellow named Marmot, Whitehall study of the British Civil Service. It turns out that that's the human equivalent of a baboon troop. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but
well, in some ways, actually, he and I have a paper in the works. We haven't settled on the title yet, but it's something like, why is a British civil servant just like a baboon? Why is a British civil servant in no way at all like a baboon? So you look at humans.
Sounds like your TED Talk where you say how we are like how humans are like primates and how primates are not at all like humans.
Oh, you know, that rhetorical parallelism that you set up there. Actually, my daughter's studying that right now, so I was forced to relearn what that was last night. British civil servants. So you look at humans, and of course, you begin to wonder, well, what about human ranking systems? And what does rank have to do with health? Because you look at the baboons, and at least on a first pass, you do not want to be a low-ranking male baboon because your health is paying for it every step of the way. Tight relationship between rank and health in these guys. So what about humans and ranking systems? And the trouble with humans is we're not a traditional ranked primate in sort of a strict linear dominance. We don't have pecking orders the way chickens do. We're more subtle than that. And one of the ways in which we're subtle is we can belong to more than one hierarchy at the same time. So you've got some poor schnook who's working in the mail room at this huge corporation, as low ranking on that hierarchy as you can get. But this is the person who's the captain of the company softball team. And you sit him down and you ask him what's more important in their life, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, or come the weekend in the softball games. And you know they've got every rationalization in place so that the hierarchy that they're higher ranking in is the one that seems more important, more salient, more emotionally satisfying to them. So we can finesse that a lot. So if you want to see health rank relationships in humans, you need a pretty clear, pretty sledgehammery of a hierarchy. And it turns out one of the greatest, clearest ones on Earth, if you want to study westernized humans, is the British civil servant system, where you have this strict rank system. I have never even like begun to figure out how many grades of civil servants they have there, but it's very strictly hierarchical, huge control for those studies. They all have access to the same health care. It's not as if the ones lower on the ladder are living out in cardboard boxes on the street and staggering, you know, all the lifestyle risk factor stuff and healthcare access stuff is controlled for. And Michael Marmot, who is sort of the god of this whole field, these classic studies going back decades showing you go down every step of the ladder in the civil service system there and health gets worse. In every domain you could measure after you control for stuff like how often you're drinking and smoking and exercising, all of that is the textbook example of how a strict hierarchical system in humans plays out in terms of health.
Even turns out to be true for people who win the Oscars as opposed to those who don't.
Spectacular study, although you got to wonder what made somebody do this a few years ago. Looking at, I don't know, how many decades worth of people who got nominated for the Oscar and either did or did not win. And I take it in that world that merely being nominated isn't quite enough to put you with the immortals, and sort of winning puts you in a whole other category. And showing that winning an Oscar, as opposed to just being nominated for it, and winning an Oscar adds something like 2 years to your life expectancy. If I recall, it only applied to the actors. It didn't apply to the techie people doing the CGI and stuff. That probably a whole different psychology there.
Our guest again is Robert Sapolsky, and he'll be with me this evening at City Arts and Lectures at Herbst Theater, part of the City Arts and Lectures series. I mentioned the TED lecture before. You gave that lecture in a gymnasium at Stanford and commented this was one of your fantasies you never thought would be realized, to be in front of a huge crowd in a basketball stadium. But you talked about theory of mind and rank and a banana with a transparent screen. And again, you were distinguishing humans from baboons by saying there's theory of mind and there's secondary theory of mind. Can you spell that out for us? Fascinating stuff.
Well, theory of mind, you know, when you start wrestling with what, if anything, still remains unique to humans, we're not the only ones that kills, that have organized violence. We're not the only ones that use tools, symbolic communication, all that sort of thing. One of the things that has remained is we're the only ones with theory of mind. This is this hugely trendy concept among psychologists. Theory of mind, the fact that you understand other people have different information than you. That you can strategically shape your own behavior based on that. And sort of the hot realm for theory of mind is when kids first acquire a theory of mind. And there's all sorts of tests for it. But the first time a kid could differentiate, say, what the actions of a character in a story should be from what their own would be, because they've got information that the character in the story doesn't. The first time they realize that there is a boundary between their consciousness and the rest of the world, and lots of interesting stuff suggesting that's the precursor to empathy, the first step in realizing that people have different thoughts than you, leading to people may have different emotions than you, realizing that at times you're just fine, somebody else may be miserable, and huge important developmental process. And for a long time, there's been this feeling that nonetheless, this is a human uniqueness. And a lot of really interesting work with chimps begin to suggest that they have theory of mind as well. And one particular sort of study that you alluded to is you take a low-ranking chimp who's in an enclosure or whatever, and on the opposite side of the room from it is a high-ranking chimp and out in the middle there's a barrier, and out comes a human and deposits a banana down on the floor on the side of the barrier that the low-ranking chimp can see. It can see this human just came out with this concealed banana, pulled out the banana, and put it down on the floor there. Two different circumstances now. Half the time, the barrier is transparent. In other words, the high-ranking chimp over on the other side can see there's a banana there also. Half the time, it's opaque. The other guy can't see. Now open up the two enclosures, let the chimps out. And the question becomes, does this low-ranking chimp go and try to grab the banana? And he shows that he's got theory of mind. If the screen, the barrier there was transparent, he knows the high-ranking chimp knows there is a banana there, and he doesn't even try. He's not going to wind up with it. If the barrier, on the other hand, was opaque, he knows the other chimp doesn't have that information, and he could make a run for it and grabs the banana. In other words, he's got theory of mind there. What has turned out to be really interesting is you can't readily show theory of mind in other primates unless it's in a competitive situation. Otherwise, they don't really care what the other guy thinks. It's only when they're strategizing that they've got to take that into account.
But on the other hand, you mentioned empathy, and you seem certainly fairly certain that animals have empathy, particularly primates have empathy, unless you get into more metaphorical realms. I mean, you use Guernica as an example, which I found kind of interesting. I mean, we can look at Guernica as humans and distinguish it as causing us pain, but this is something beyond animal consciousness, so far as we can imagine animal consciousness or really understand it, divine it even.
Well, again, one of those issues of we're special, but we're not so special as a species, but it turns out we're kind of special after all. I mean, just to pick up again on the theory of mind. So, okay, we're not the only species then with theory of mind, even though we may use it in more circumstances. What humans seem to still be unique with is what they call secondary theory of mind. We understand that individual A has information that individual B doesn't have, and A knows it and B doesn't, and where you can follow what's going on there. Essentially, what you need is secondary theory of mind to follow any like plot of Shakespeare where there's like gender switching and who thinks who is who and all of that. Like no chimp on earth could ever possibly follow the plot of Midsummer Night's Dream kind of thing. So we still have that more elaborate realm. In terms of empathy, the same thing, what you bring up. And there's, you know, more and more evidence that we are not the only species that can feel somebody else's pain. And remarkably, neurobiological studies suggest like real hardcore underlining of how this might work in the brain and not just in us. We're not the only species that can be empathic, but we have a range of empathy like nothing out there. We can feel empathic for a picture of a suffering animal, for the horse in Guernica. We can, you know, occasionally I show this slide in lectures about this to a picture from Avatar when Home Tree is collapsing on the poor Navi. And like the audience, they all go, oh, no, it's Home Tree. Home Tree, they don't even exist. This is there's no such place as Pandora. Yet you're feeling. You feel empathy for some poor character in a novel. You feel empathy reading for people stuck in Pompeii as the volcano erupted thousands. We feel sorry for the whole planet as the icebergs melt. So we're not the only species with empathy, but wow, we can just abstract it in ways nobody else can come close to.
You also write about what you call the beauty of swarm intelligence, behavior algorithms, and say, in fact, it appeals to your atheist self, which I think at one point you describe as strident. But talk about swarm intelligence and behavioral algorithms.
It's totally beautiful stuff, and I'm only limited here by the fact that I've got like very superficial knowledge of it, not being a mathematician. It's this whole notion of like undoing centuries of Western thought about how you understand complex systems. Okay, how do you understand something complicated? You got a clock that doesn't work anymore. So what do? You break it down to its component parts and you look for the part that's got something wrong with it. You take the clock apart down to its gears and aha, there's the gear that has a broken tooth or whatever, and you fix that one piece and you put all the pieces back together again and it's fixed and it runs wonderfully. The way you understand a complex system is to break it down into its little parts, understand the component parts, and then all you have to do is add them up again in this like straight linear counting on your toes way, and it all makes sense.
Voila. I'm going to give out the phone number. You're welcome to join us. We're talking about stress, primate behavior, and much more with Robert Sapolsky. Your calls and emails are welcome. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join us by phone at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to Facebook page. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny talking with one of our nation's leading primatologists, also professor of biology, neurology, and neurological science and neurosurgery at Stanford School of Medicine, Robert Sapolsky, with us in studio for the hour. And just want to get to your calls here. And by the way, you can join us not only by phone, but by email, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. And if you haven't signed up for the Facebook page yet, you probably want to do that because it's growing and it's got all kinds of tidbits on it. We were talking, and actually our phone number again, toll-free, is 866-733-6786. We were talking a little bit about swarm intelligence before we went to the break, though. And why is this beautiful to you? There's a whole aesthetic to that to you.
There is. So we've got that break something complicated into its itty-bitty little parts approach. And what swarm intelligence focuses on is the fact that that's not how the interesting stuff works. Human brains, behavior, society, ecosystems, whatever, don't work like clocks that are broken. You can't break them down into their component parts. And what you're left with then instead is, ooh, do we just have some like Zen sort of, okay, you got to just do some whole holistic thing. Are there no rules for breaking down complexity? And this whole world of sort of emergent complex systems, swarm intelligence being one example, is the answer to it. And sort of the perfect metaphor is you take some big table and you put an ant on it and watch what it does, and it makes no sense whatsoever. And you let 10 ants there do their thing and they still make no sense, and 100 they make no sense, and 1,000 or so, I don't know what the transition point is, and they suddenly start making sense. And you put a whole bunch of them and they start making sense big time. They build colonies, they grow fungi, they regulate the temperature of their colonies, they have specializations, they suddenly make huge amounts of sense. And the two amazing things about this so-called swarm intelligence, one is that it's all done with some very simple rules, very local rules for how one ant interacts with when it bumps into a food source, when it bumps into another ant.
You're in E.O. Wilson territory here, aren't you?
Yes, indeed. But it's taking it one step further, and this is where my atheistic soul begins to sing. First point being, there's not many rules, and the second is, there's no blueprint. The queen of an ant colony has no idea what's going on. She's just a breeding machine. There's nobody in charge. What you have instead are what are called emergent simple rules for how you deal with local neighbors, some very simple rules, and get enough bits and cogs of those simple rules thrown into some place, and out comes something as beautiful and organized as an ant colony. And there's no blueprint. And when you look at things like how the nervous system wires up, it shows some of the exact same principles as with swarm intelligence. When you show all sorts of aspects of complex biological systems, what's the punchline lurking there over and over? No blueprint, no blueprint maker.
Yeah. I reference a poem I love by Robert Frost called Design. He talks about the design despite the fact that there may not be a blueprint maker, because it's a design that comes from sort of random distribution or quantum mechanics, but it's still a design. We're going to go to our callers here in just a moment. I just want to ask you, though, I got lots of things to ask you. Let's go to our callers. I'll refrain. I'll go right to Santa Clara. Kim, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on free will versus determinism.
Oh, might as well start off with a nice little easy one to take on.
I always quote Isaac Bashev, a singer, the Nobel Prize-winning Yiddish writer, when I asked him, do you believe in free will? Very solemnly, and he said, I have no choice. I thought it was brilliant.
I cannot remember the name of the theologian, but was reading somebody recently who basically made the argument that it is so wondrous and amazing and remarkable that God gave us free will that we have no choice but to worship him. And the trouble is, this person didn't see any irony in the statement there. Free will, I don't think there's a whole lot of it. I think on a good energized day, I would argue there's none at all. But if there is any free will, it's in all the least interesting places of behavior, and come back 10, 20, 50 years from now, and those little uninteresting corners of free will are going to have shrunk more and more.
When you get tough questions like that, I think, in fact, when people always ask you, as I'm sure they do, what about nature and nurture and where do you stand by? I imagine you must be thinking, it's the interaction, stupid. Like Bill Clinton said, it's the economy, stupid, right?
Well, that is kind of the sort of at this point, you kind of get your neurobiology lecturer license taken away from you if you can't at some point go through it's not nature, it's not nurture, it's the interaction of the two, and, you know, incredibly cool, interesting ways in which that interact. Nonetheless, at the end of the day, everybody's sort of gut on a certain level is, so is it my genes that made me do it? Is it somebody else's genes that made them do it? There's a very strong attributional pull towards not deciding something's due to complex interactions of things, but instead has sort of a single cause. Okay, here's the greatest—
Who has the authority to take away your license as a neurobiologist?
Oh, the ghost of Charles Darwin or somebody or
I'm sorry, you're about to make another point.
Okay, greatest example of sort of gene-environment interaction in a way that really impacts like how people go about their lives. Okay, depression, major biological disorder, devastating, huge, horrible. We've got only baby steps in understanding how it works. Treatments are miserably inadequate in terms of the number of people who are not helped by it. And what's clear is there is a genetic component to depression. And all sorts of scientists have been racing for years to try to track down genes for depression. And I have put a quotation marks around the four in the ooh, it's all genetic nature kind of way. And there have been all sorts of candidate genes that have something to do with the kind of brain chemistry that's been fingered in depression. And there's this one gene that was a prime candidate. And for those who care about such things, it's got something to do with levels of this neurotransmitter serotonin. Serotonin, Prozac works on the serotonin system. Anyway, it was a logical candidate. This type of gene comes with a few different flavors. And this group discovering that these two different versions of this gene mapped out to a certain extent with increased versus decreased risk of getting a depression. Okay, that's great. That's this hugely important finding. This was a group led by Avshalom Kaspi at Duke University. And what did they find seemingly on first pass? Ooh, they found a genetic basis for depression. In other words, knowing which flavor of this gene someone has is going to tell you, are they seriously at risk for depression or not? That's not remotely what their data showed. What they showed was having the bad version of this gene greatly increased your risk of depression if and only if you were raised in a stressful environment. Childhood trauma, loss of a parent to death, acrimonious divorce. Is this a gene that determined your risk of depression? No, this was a gene that interacted with how stressful an environment you had early in life. Like the perfect example of it's not genes, it's not environment, it's the interaction of the two. They're inseparable.
But it suggests that perhaps genetically you had, I hesitate to use the word, a proclivity toward depression if you had the trauma or the circumstances.
Perfect. That's exactly the word to use. Moving away from genetic determinism to genetic proclivities, genetic predispositions, genetic vulnerabilities, that's everything about the genetics of how the brain works and behavior.
We go to more of your calls. Brandon, join us. You're on.
Hi, you guys. Good morning. I just want to I was first introduced to Dr. Sapolsky's work in a movie called Moving Forward, made by Peter Joseph, and it was really an amazing synthesis of modern economics, namely the predominating belief that we have in our culture, that everybody should work hard, rugged capitalism, hyper-individualism. But in that film, you basically made a point and showed how we really are not as autonomous as we think, like, kind of like what you just said with the ant example a few minutes ago. But also, in that film, you made the point that a child, if not touched, it will actually literally die, and how different genes are turned on and off. I mean, I worked with Affymetrix microarray chips, and we'd, you know, manipulate genes expression by just the environment. So I saw on a molecular level what you were talking about. But what was so interesting is that that work could largely explain how, in America, how really we can't be as individualistic as capitalism lends us to all think. That is my main point. But what is your thought on that film? That film really, again, introduced me to your work. And I thought, again, it was an amazing synthesis of the larger points that you make in your work and modern day economics and capitalism versus.
Okay, let's go to the question you're raising.
Robert
Sapolsky.
Thank you. I'm going to disappoint you, though, in that I've never seen the film. And I also don't know anything about economics. This was some film crew that showed up and they sort of asked me a bunch of questions about stuff, and I pontificated on, and I think they gave me some donuts afterward and left. And about 4 years later, some film emerged, and I've never actually seen it. But what it sounds like, I kind of agree with what I said in it, which is a good thing. But the issue you bring up, sort of okay, individualism and sort of the isolated state that could get you in, and alluded to a whole world of stress-related diseases you are more at risk for if you were isolated. On a certain level, you know, that is kind of what defines the United States. We, on the average, live further than where we were born than in any other country. We are more likely to be surrounded by strangers whose names we don't know. We change our names. We get rid of our accents. We get unlisted phone numbers. And oh, for those of us from sort of descendants of sort of recent immigrants, I'm first generation. We're all the descendants of people who were cranky, misanthropic folks back where they came from, who barely made their way out three steps in front of the secret police and came here and never looked back. We're a pretty socially disconnected society compared to sort of most others. What does that get us? That's got us Silicon Valley. That's gotten us our level of achievement, that's gotten our level of innovation, a number of patents. We're a society of like restless cranks, or at least out here in the Bay Area we are. And that's great. And that does wonders for income and CVs and all of that. And then along comes something like 9/11 and we remember we have no idea who our neighbors are. So there's, you know, definitely an upside to all this, but most certainly a downside as well, and some health consequences of that downside.
But you've pointed out some of the upside, particularly in terms of peace. I was reading a piece of yours, and you were talking about how Nelson Mandela was wrong, that you shouldn't it's not best to talk to their minds, but to talk to their hearts. This is in a piece you did in the New York Times, and you said, talk to their insulas and their cingulate cortices. But I was struck by just the attitude that you had from your work with the baboons, that they could sort of thin out their ranks, and you would have more peaceful baboons eventually, again, because of the stress and the dominance and the aggression of the higher-ranked baboons. And you use these analogies of Germany and Japan, you know, now presumably peaceful nations, or Sweden, which was a fairly pugnative nation or warlike nation. It's almost as if there has to be a change, and that change occurs, and that change in those cases is an ameliorative change for the better.
Well, this was an undesired study that I wound up doing on one of my troops of baboons, and for really complicated reasons I won't go into, in the mid-80s, half the adult males in the troop died. And it wasn't just random who died for reasons having to do with this disaster. The ones who died were the males who were most aggressive and least socially connected. Socially connected, least interested in sitting around and grooming with the other animals, that sort of thing. What you were left with was half the number of males, and these were unaggressive, highly affiliated nice guys, to get technical. And what this did was produce a very different troop atmosphere. As I noted before, baboons, especially male baboons, just specialize in making the smaller and weaker miserable when they're in a bad mood. Male baboons taking it out like crazy on females, displacement aggression. Suddenly, this was a much nicer, much more peaceful troop. Isn't that great?
These are the ones that combed each other and stuff.
Yes, exactly, and meditated in hot tubs and such. But what was most striking, as I mentioned before, male baboons leave their home natal birth troops around puberty and then transfer slowly into their adult troop, go away and come back a decade later after the death of these guys, and there was still this atmosphere in this troop, less aggressive, more socially affiliated. But then you sort of get thunderstruck by realizing none of the males from around the time that those deaths occurred, none of those nice guy survivors are still around. They've passed on. Who are the adult males in the troop now? These are guys who joined the troop as squirrely adolescents sometime in the aftermath. In other words, these are guys who grew up in other troops out in the normal, miserable, bad baboon world and came into this commune at adolescence, and they somehow learned, we don't act that way here. We do things differently.
But even with the next generation, there's a kind of cultural transmission that goes on, isn't there?
And that's exactly the word that one should use, despite the fact that this gives lots of social anthropologists conniptions. This is culture and this is transmission. This is the non-genetic transmission of behavioral traits. And what sort of my work was able to show was that when these new guys show up who are just as aggressive as adolescents transferring into any other troop, growing up there out in the real world, they show up and it takes them about 6 months or so to settle down and get less aggressive and more affiliative and reestablish that culture. And what they do is they assimilate each new typical adolescent who shows up. What the work showed was sort of a key driving point on it actually is the behavior of the females. Because you get in a typical troop, again, half the aggression going on is somebody taking it out on somebody smaller, meaning females are pretty anxious a lot of the time with big aggressive males around. Get rid of the big aggressive jerks and females are more relaxed. Females are more relaxed, less stressed, and my physiology studies then showed that to be the case. More relaxed, some new stranger transfer male baboon shows up, and you're more willing to take a chance reaching out to him. In a typical troop, it's about 60, 70 days or so after some new guy transfers in before the first female grooms him. In this troop, 4 or 5 days. They just get treated in a more affiliative manner by the females a lot sooner. And I think what you got is some sort of default cascade. In a world in which females are not being regularly terrorized by the males, they're more relaxed and more socially proactive out to strangers. In a world in which stranger male baboons are treated nicer by the residents, it takes them about 6 months to calm down. And this whole more peaceful social culture in this troop is then passed on.
Now, here's this peaceful social culture compared to, let's say, orangutans who almost have no social culture and bonobos who are peaceful most of the time. In fact, there are a lot of people who would prefer that we're to think of us being like bonobos since they're so easy about their sexuality and their appetites are all pretty much taken for granted and expressed. And they're also peaceful. I mean, that seems like it. And they're an endangered species now, aren't they?
Extremely. Bonobos, you know, at any given point in zoology circles, there's like some totally trendy, sexy species to be studying, which baboons have never been. So you're always envious of somebody studying for a while. It was hyenas, and then it was naked mole rats who are actually totally cool. But bonobos have been the it species for some years now. They're relatives closely related to the typical normal chimp species, but they're a separate species, and they've got a totally different social system. Regular chimps, as we heard, they kill, they murder, they have something that looks like proto-warfare, they build weapons, they're very, very aggressive, bruising. Bonobos, very little of aggression, female-dominated. You solve every single social tension on Earth with sex with as many other bonobos as possible. This totally sort of—
Gender being unimportant.
Gender being gender pairings, 2, 3, 20 at a time, totally irrelevant. People like at primatology conferences, they go to the bonobo talks just to see the films that get shown. That's how like wonderful bonobos are. And you look at them and you say, aha, our lost Garden of Eden. And so then you got to get some qualifiers coming up in there. Okay, so we got chimps and we got bonobos. Who are our closer relatives? Sort of this great soundbite that turns out to be true, which is chimps share about 98% of our DNA with us. Incredibly, bonobos are just as related. They're very close related. Chimps are very closely related.
So are fruit flies.
And fruit flies not that much further. And we're not chimps. We're not bonobos. We're not obviously more closely related to either. Bonobos are really good at reconciliation. Whoa, wait a second. You can't reconcile unless you're having fights. It's not the Garden of Eden. And we're not bonobos, nor are we chimps. We're close relatives. But we're a very different species that have solved very different ecological challenges. We're close, but we're not synonymous. There's lessons to be learned, but limited ones.
Kevin, you're our next caller. Join us. Hi.
Yeah, hi. On a show a few years ago, there was a doctor explaining that in a stressful situation that we humans secrete adrenaline very quickly. However, it takes 7 or 8 hours for it to dissipate from our bodies. So it's not exactly that we think ourselves into stress, but that we are perhaps a prisoner once we get there. Has there been any research on the endocrine systems of the primates besides the human, or does the guest agree with this?
Perfect. That's a hugely important observation and a great way of sort of phrasing it, us then being prisoners of having turned on our stress response. When you look at what goes wrong in terms of chronic stress and the hormones, adrenaline, et cetera, things that can go wrong, it is very rare that what goes wrong is you have trouble turning on a stress response or getting it to the optimal magnitude. That's not where the weakness is. The weakness is exactly what you allude to. It's turning it off once you've turned it on. As we get older, the size of our stress response, adrenaline, or there's other stress hormones involved, cortisol, for example, the size of the response doesn't change with age. As we get older, it gets harder to recover back to baseline. People with major clinical depression, recovery from stressors gets slowed down. People with all sorts of realms of that, that's where the vulnerability is. It isn't turning on the stress response, it's recovering from it. And that's precisely what you see, say, amid the baboons, low-ranking male baboons who've got, on the average, some of the crummier profiles in terms of health. They're just as good at secreting stress hormones as do high-ranking guys during a crisis. It takes them longer to turn things off. That's where the vulnerability is.
And a listener writes, how do primates dissipate stress?
Well, one of the most reliable ways is real familiar, and which I keep mentioning, which is you find somebody smaller to take it out on. One of the tragedies of social life on this planet is the fact that displacement aggression is stress reducing. It's pathetic and it's tragic truly to see, but a great way of making an organism less stressed is to let it take it out on somebody else.
That's why we see so much road rage maybe too.
Absolutely. That's why you see rates of child abuse and spousal abuse go up during periods of economic downturn. And take a lab rat that gets unexpectedly shocked every now and then, and what do you know, its blood pressure goes up. Give it the opportunity each time it gets a shock to bite another rat, and its blood pressure doesn't go up. So that's one of the most effective, terrible ways in which primates dissipate stress. What's clear is, just as effectively when things are working right is instead social affiliation and somebody's shoulder to cry on, or as studies suggest, even more effectively, having your shoulder be available for somebody else to cry on. Those ones are a lot harder to get to work effectively than just beating up on someone smaller, metaphorically or literally. But those are really the only
healthy
options. This
is an observation, not an advocacy, right?
Exactly.
Let me read some comments, from the web and from our emails. This listener writes, good thing you allow commenting online, because if I tried calling in, I'd be a babbling fangirl. I would like Professor Sapolsky to know what the garbage dump baboon story means to me. When I first heard it, I thought it was apocryphal and was overjoyed when I found it was real. I reflect on it often and repeat it as an illustration that gating resources is not a greater good. I'm not even in the sciences, just an English major technical writer who appreciates science. Thank you, Professor Sapolsky, for providing such a hope-filled story. Want to give us a quick rendering of the garbage dump story?
Well, that's the one that I was referring to before, the circumstance that killed half my males. The neighboring baboon troop had a tourist lodge in their territory. Tourist lodge had a garbage dump that was not well contained. Neighboring troops spent all day long feeding on the garbage in there, the leftover food. Interesting footnote, something I was able to study in those neighboring guys. Their cholesterol levels went up. Their triglyceride levels went up. They got mildly insulin resistant. Same deal as we get eating westernized diets. The males in my troop somehow got word that there was garbage available up there, good leftovers, and only the males who were aggressive enough to be able to fight their way into the neighboring troop's domain and get some of the garbage were able to do this, going there daily. Only the males who were socially disconnected enough that they were willing to forego the morning social grooming to go and fight their way for leftover British desserts from the tourist lodge. And what happened was there was a tuberculosis outbreak centered on contaminated meat in that garbage dump, which killed basically all the males in that neighboring troop and killed all the males in my troop who went to feed there.
So the more aggressive males got wiped out.
That's what the selection
was. That was the thinning of the herd. Yeah.
Which has led me to a fairly jaundiced notion that maybe something we need to do for world peace is give aggressive males tubercular meat.
Or Bertrand Russell used to say, just actually throw them into pits and let them wrestle each other or fight pachyderms or something like that. Just get rid of all that aggression in that kind of channeled way. Let me get another email here. Professor Sapolsky talks about swarm intelligence. The system in which the swarm intelligence operates in nature is itself subject of evolutionary improvement. However, in humans, the systems are usually designed quickly without understanding their impact. So instead of swarm intelligence, we also get swarm stupidity. Mass media, particularly tabloid TV, has a way of promoting swarm stupidity.
There's a new concept. Observation. The core of that probably being emotional contagion.
I think we've got a caller on point here. Ken, hi.
Hi. A real privilege to be on your show. So my thought would be that swarm intelligence in humans might be more related to rules, like, say, in Congress. I know Luntz on the Republican side, and then there's a Berkeley professor I don't remember who talks about framing.
George Lakoff.
Lakoff, yes.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that Congress has got much less friendly lately, and is that a side effect of swarm intelligence or swarm rules?
Well, I'd like to think not, since that really gives the social insects a bad name. I really could not answer that, though, until I got sort of urine samples from all the members of Congress and analyzed some
hormones. Oh, good luck with that. I'd like to see you get one from Rand Paul, for example, and some of the Tea Party people.
Well, I think I draw a line there, for even science would not force me to do that.
Your science now, getting back to garbage dumps and tourist places, it's gone more into the lab. It's had to, hasn't it?
Yep. Unfortunately, I'm doing less and less of the field work out there with the baboons, intersection of, variety of things, much of it having to do with growing up. At some point, you can't quite spend 3-4 months a year in a tent.
Well, please continue the good work you're doing on whatever level, and thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll be with us again. Again, I'll be with Robert Sapolsky tonight at the City Arts and Lectures at the Herb Theater. Thank you for being part of this hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.